This is CliffCentral.com.
Thursday morning. It's almost September. Yes, you didn't think it was going to happen that quickly, but it comes at you suddenly like a thief in the night. And then before you know it, you're at the end of the year and we're already downhill until the ultimate new year in 2020 just around the corner.
Hey.
I know, it's scary. So, good morning. If you have just woken up and this is the start of your day, well, lucky you. You get the Burning Platform, which is brought to you by Nando's. Every Thursday morning, we deliver it really, really hot, or lemon and herb, or peri-peri, depending on how you like it. And this morning is no different. There's plenty to talk about today. Canthan Pillay is here. Pumi Mashiko is here. And you are part of the conversation. You know what to do if you want to join in. 0797482090. Where shall we begin? Is there something that is burning on your platform this morning, Pumi or Canthan?
Well, this morning I've mainly been concerned with looking up exactly what a camshaft hall sensor is.
Why?
Because the diagnostics on my car have shown that I need to replace the camshaft hall sensor, and I did not know that such a thing existed. So.
Sounds terrible. Is it painful?
No, but it's an interesting exercise in any case. You guys probably don't know this, but, you know, when I got my first job and I was poor, you know, I bought a used car and then I rebuilt the engine myself, which was, you know, kind of a fun thing to do. And, you know, given that, you know, one of the vehicles that I drive is a 21-year-old Merc, it's actually still possible to do stuff on it yourself because it's not all about the electronics.
Well, a lot of people, including me, you buy a car, and then when something goes wrong, you ask someone to help you fix it. And some people don't even maintain their cars. And then we see these burnt-out vehicles on the side of the road, and we wonder, how does this happen? It would be helpful if more South
Africans... No, those were just Ford Cougars, and it was a factory fault.
Yeah, but don't you think? Don't you think most of us would do well to look after what we've already got? It would seem to me that this is what for most people might be the most expensive thing they ever buy, a car or a house, and they don't look after their houses and don't look after their cars. And then when they go backwards and financially they're in ruin, they go, oh, how did this happen to me? It must be someone else's fault.
Yeah, well, preventive maintenance is always better than, you know, having stuff kind of break down. And the same is true in terms of your health, pretty much. You know,
well, that's it.
Yeah.
And that you're going to lead us down the NHI path.
I think we did the NHI to death last week, and
literally,
and the NHI is going to do us to death pretty soon. So, yeah. You know, let's just park it. No, look, the interesting thing is that when, you know, recession looms, that's the point at which people start actually taking this stuff seriously. You spend more time on maintenance because you can't actually afford to replace something when it goes down.
Right.
So, in fact, the piece that I wrote this week, I was talking about men's underwear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because what tends to happen is that in times of recession, you can actually track whether a recession is coming based on the sales of men's underwear, and it very specifically is men's underwear, not women's underwear.
Because we buy, you know, underwear.
Yeah, because the thing is that, you know, men can go into the locker room with a pair of torn undies, and we actually don't give a shit.
No, nobody cares.
Yeah. So,
Sia cares. Yeah, but the rest of the
yeah, but everything else, you know, that kind of gets displayed in the open. I mean, you can't go into work with a torn shirt.
So have they? Published research on this?
Well, it was Alan Greenspan who first came up with the idea, and it was way before he became head of the Federal Reserve. Fascinating character, Alan Greenspan. You know, every bit I read about him actually, really stirs up my intrigue glands. He's quite an amazing character.
So what did he say about this? What you've just postulated now.
Yeah, pretty much.
During a recession, you can tell if things are going badly because men's underwear gets worse and more holy.
He would track the state of the U.S. economy by actually observing people's behavioral patterns, you know, in terms of how they spend and where they spend it and so forth. For example, right now, do you know that in New York City that 4,000 people who used to work in the restaurant industry no longer have jobs?
Really?
Because they raised the minimum wage
$15,
and so those people are out of jobs. And more to the point, no one is opening new restaurants in New York City. right now because
and one of the reasons
because it's too expensive but to find the space.
One of the reasons people go to New York City is to the restaurants. Well, I mean, it used to be the there used to be millions of these places, and you could eat a different meal every night and never leave Manhattan. For 5 years in a row, you'd never have to go to the same restaurant.
Well, when I was a young adult, you know, we used to go to New York to hit the hookers and pawn shops on 42nd Street. Not that I did.
Well, but that was before Giuliani supposedly cleaned it up.
Before Giuliani cleaned it up.
And since de Blasio's come in and made it filthy again.
I actually made a point of taking my wallet out of my pocket on Times Square so that I could tell people that I did that without getting mugged.
Wow. And that used to be a massive achievement.
Absolutely,
in
Now,
let's just, while we're on New York, and we do have to refer to American politics because the Democratic primaries are coming up at some point in the next couple of weeks, and they're going to have to decide who their candidate is. And there's still some minnows wallowing in the background of the Democratic lineup. And really, some of these people are embarrassing and should just get out. A guy called John Hickenlooper left the race last week. Who even knew? Anybody?
Well, we're going to miss him.
And by the way, how do you loop a hicken, and what is that? So there's that to ask. The other person who's interesting is Bill de Blasio, who's the mayor of New York, who's running as one of the Democratic candidates for president. He is so unpopular in New York that Donald Trump, remember, New York's a very blue state. It's a very blue city. No one in New York votes Republican, and if they do, they keep it very much to themselves.
Well, they did vote Giuliani back in the day.
They did in those days, but I'm afraid things are very much more partisan now than they've ever been. People hate Trump in New York City, but you know what? They hate de Blasio more. Bill de Blasio is more unpopular than Donald Trump in the city of New York.
You know, they hate Donald Trump so much, though. They're running a petition to change the name of the street where Trump Towers is to Barack Obama. So that Trump Towers is... I mean, they're running an online petition. They've got something like 100,000 signatures on this petition. They just hate Donald Trump just to, like, irritate him.
Well, I don't think that's necessarily hating Donald Trump. I think that's trolling. Kind of trolling him. Yeah. You know? And I think it's a cool thing to do.
Well, maybe you can help me understand what the big story is with him in Denmark. Is it all about Greenland? Because we discussed that earlier this week, that he said, if they're interested in selling Greenland, we might be interested. It would be a good real estate deal to buy Greenland. And apparently Denmark and he are in this open battle at the moment about what to do with Greenland and whether or not they're up for sale. I'm not sure that there's more to it, but I saw that he's visiting Denmark.
No, he's actually called off the visit because in fact, I think he tweeted that he was irritated with the view of the Denmark Prime Minister that, you know, that Greenland wasn't for sale. So, you know, if he can't make a deal, why would he want to be going there? Look, it's not as though there's any real reason for Trump to be doing a state visit to Denmark, you know, because I mean, they're part of the EU. So it's not like he's going to be striking bilaterals with them or something like that. So I really think it's an opportunity for Trump to get, you know, far more publicity in terms of the stuff that he does. And of course, the American press reacts with complete and utter outrage. How can you even think of buying another country? Well, guess what? I think it's a good thing that the U.S. is thinking of buying other countries because they stole California, they stole Texas, they stole Arizona from Mexico.
Well, they may have, but they also paid for and bought Alaska from Russia, and they bought Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, and a bunch of other states in the South from the French.
Yes, because those guys had bigger guns at the time.
Yeah, but they paid for them. They bought and paid for them.
They certainly did. Unlike Hawaii, where they basically introduced measles as biological warfare to wipe out the population, and they just strolled in and took control of it.
Well, our history is full of conquest, and whether or not you like that or
not, let's just bat a flag because that'll make life a lot better.
Well, I wanted your opinion on this because Pumi and I briefly touched on it during the five things you need to know this morning. But what do you think of this flag ban? Is this an important thing?
Look, the really irritating part for me is the fact that the Nelson Mandela Foundation were the people who brought this to the forefront. And look, I certainly don't, you know, at any level claim to represent the views of the former president, but certainly everything that I knew about him would never have stood for banning it. So that's just one level at which I want to park this thing.
Okay.
And, but
It's just it's a hollow victory against a foe that doesn't really exist.
We've spoken about this before. Whenever I look at the old South African flag, my reaction is to say, ha ha, you guys lost.
Right.
And it's a constant reminder of the defeat that apartheid suffered. And at that level, the new South African flag is a symbol of triumph. So why do you want to lose the opportunity to actually point a finger at that solitary person who's going to pitch up at a rugby match displaying the old South African flag? Maybe, I just say, look at that idiot. Everyone turns their phones on.
Maybe someone who can, let's say there's someone who considers this a massive victory. Here we are 25 years after the end of apartheid and South Africa has got its own new challenges. We've got a whole generation of new young people who didn't even know that flag they wouldn't have recognized it if you'd shown it to them in a flashcard. And there are people who are excited about this. They think that this ruling by the Equality Court is a big deal. And I feel like those people really need to experience a proper victory in their life, because this is not apart from a few, as you say, pariahs on the outsides. And I don't think it's a lot of people. I mean, even AfriForum, who supposedly were defending this motion.
Let's be very clear. AfriForum has said
they don't support
displaying the flag.
Yeah, so their point is that they are fighting this on the basis of freedom of speech, because it is a slippery slope. Once you go down.
And I actually agree with AfriForum on that particular point, because it is a slippery slope for me.
Once government tells you can and can't say certain things, they tell you can and can't display certain things, next thing you know, they'll be telling us all that we need to wear black every Thursday for the burning platform. It's not too much of a stretch. I don't want government involved in my personal decisions. The flag is immaterial to me. But what if they say that from now on we're not allowed to sing Vicky Sampson's African Dream? Let's say they decide that that's cultural appropriation or something, because there's a story about that I want to ask you about in a second.
What?
Yeah, then suddenly, what, we all have to follow that or go to jail for singing Vicky Sampson's African Dream? Do me a favor. It's just unnecessary for government to involve themselves in this thing. There's no damage being done to people with an old flag being displayed somewhere. It's just ridiculous to the person who's displaying it.
Well, it's kind of like the guy who got convicted for teaching his girlfriend's dog to do the Hitler salute. You remember that?
Well, that's equally ridiculous, yeah. And that was in Britain.
Exactly.
So here's a law.
So the stupidity is around the world.
Here's a law I want you to know about. The president has signed the Protection, Promotion, Development, and Management of Indigenous Knowledge Bill into law. You didn't know this, but Cyril's been on a signing spree in the last couple of days with the Arto Bill and a bunch of others. This is one of the ones he signed. This new act aims to prevent the unauthorized use and misappropriation of knowledge developed over time by the country's indigenous communities. It's called the Cultural Appropriation Act. Now, I need someone to explain to me. Cultural appropriation is not a real thing. Cultural appropriation, when it works, is called diversity. It's called multiculturalism. It's something worth celebrating. There is no part of anybody's culture which belongs to them in perpetuity and to their heirs. That does not, otherwise, we all have to stop sharing paper, which the Chinese invented. We all have to stop sharing most of Western philosophy.
Well,
which
sub-Saharan
the Greeks
Africa would starve because we all eat mealy meal, which came from the U.S.
Correct.
From the Americas. Really.
So let's stop with this bullshit about cultural appropriation, or do you disagree?
Well, let's put a different spin on this, okay? One of the issues that we've got right now in terms of indigenous knowledge, and look, let's be very clear, there is a wealth of indigenous knowledge which has never been documented.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in order for anyone to actually claim that something is indigenous knowledge, they first need to go through a process of documenting it.
Correct.
Which I think is a good thing to do, because, you know, again, one of the issues that we've got right now is the number of people who claim to represent indigenous knowledge at a number of levels, but in fact are charlatans, which is why you have things like initiation ceremonies where you have people who
children
basically
die.
Yeah, people die. And so I think the idea of actually starting a process of documenting stuff is really important. But really the process at which this needs to start is with expanding the scope of indigenous languages. You know, I'm very convinced right now that indigenous languages, in South Africa are going to be extinct within a 20-year period. And I've said this several times before. And the reason for that is that there isn't an investment in actually ensuring that the languages are documented, that the languages are actually expanded, that the scope of the dictionary actually grows, so that you can actually participate using your indigenous languages in the first world economy. When you don't have concepts like the fourth industrial revolution, as an example, mm-hmm. being translated into indigenous languages, how do you then get to the point of being able to explain it to people? You know, and Afrikaans has been doing that, by the way, as the sole exception to the indigenous languages that we have.
You know, you say that. Just earlier I was telling you that one of the things for me that's very irritating about so many of these bills that get signed is that the enforceability of it is so lax. But last week, which again shows the ineptitude of our Department of Arts and Culture and their role in documenting indigenous languages, documenting the indigenous knowledge systems that we have, is Baba Okredo Mutwa. I don't know, you know, very famous for all of the work and art he's created and the history that he's added into our country. But, you know, somebody was visiting his home in Kuruman. And it started trending last week just how derelict it is. And there was a commitment by the Department of Arts and Culture and the Lotteries Board to build a museum to house all of his stuff. And it's all half done. So it's all well and good that, you know, done. President Cupcake is signing up on these things on the other side.
Kaifa
but
Semenya,
the right hand is not doing the work that needs to be done.
On that note, I don't know what the Department of Arts and Culture do, but Kaifa Semenya was on TV.
They tweet about people who died.
Yeah, that's what, isn't that the ANC Women's League job? Kaifa Semenya turned 80 this week, and he's trying to build an arts center, and it's half built, and he's looking for funding. And they were showing it on the news like it was already achieved. And there's this, again, derelict building. It's got no roof. It's got two out of four walls built. And here's this guy who is an institution in South African music. We're celebrating him and regaling him on the news.
World music.
He's on the news. We're celebrating him, and they have to show these photographs of this defunct, derelict building as if it is an achievement. Is this how paltry our last 25 years of building and expansion and growth and development have been? All we can do is rename old things and find things that we try to reappropriate rather than misappropriate or culturally appropriate because we haven't built enough new ones. This is embarrassing. That it was on the news is even more embarrassing. For Kaifa Semenya, I'm embarrassed.
To be needing to, like, go on the news to look for funding. Like, what?
Outrageous. It's just, it's humiliating in the extreme. And it shows you how low the standards are when we can consider a victory against a dead flag as a victory. And there are real people out there trying to do things and they can't get them done.
Build new things.
Correct. All right, let's talk to someone who's an expert on the subject that we're going to get into in a moment. He's from the Right to Know campaign. Tami Nkosi is the protest surveillance and securitization organizer of the Right to Know campaign. We're talking about the arms deal Seriti Commission situation. The High Court in Pretoria, as we discussed earlier, set aside the report and the findings of the Seriti Commission of Inquiry, which investigated the controversial arms deal. And on the line to tell us a little bit about this is Tami. Tami, good morning. How are you? Hello, Tami. Is he there? Oh, Sia's just getting him on the line.
Sia's signaling.
By setting aside this Seriti Commission, what they've really done.
What was that job title again?
quite a thing.
It's a hell of a job title. You want to hear it? He's the Chief Protest Surveillance and Securitization Organizer.
Dude, I totally want to be writing job titles in this place.
Isn't it great?
Uh-huh.
Is he on the line? Okay.
Oh, we're still tight.
So what do we think about the fact that they've set this aside before we get to Tami?
Well, I don't know. What exactly does it mean that when it's been set aside? I haven't seen the judgment.
It means you can wipe that from...
It means that it's a waste of time.
You see, the devil is in the detail in these things. And, you know, if effectively what the Chief Justice said was that the findings were inconclusive and therefore irrelevant, then, you know, that would make sense. But I haven't seen the judgment, so I'll reserve judgment until I've had a look at it.
What I did see yesterday was that they did not do enough to consider all of the evidence, and therefore the commission's work did not comply with the terms of reference.
Okay, that's a good definition. Yeah.
All right. Is Tummy there now?
Is Tummy? Is that Tummy? Okay.
Hey, this is getting Tummy. So it's like trying to talk to the astronauts when you're President Nixon in 1960. Are they ready yet?
But basically saying that they failed to consider all of the evidence that was put, that could have been put in front of them. Therefore, their report that there was no wrongdoing is incorrect. Therefore, it must be set aside because there was wrongdoing because they did not consider all of the evidence.
Well, this is the Right to Know campaigns. They were the ones who brought this to court,
yes,
and asked for the commission to be declared, to be set aside and for the arms deal to be reviewed. So let's talk to Tummy. Hi, Tummy. How are you?
And nothing.
Tummy?
Hey, Gareth, morning, and morning to your guest there.
Yeah, morning.
How are you?
Good, good, good. So, Tummy, first of all, a victory for you guys to have the whole commission set aside. This is also a precedent case in some ways. It means that courts in the future can set aside findings from a commission of inquiry. That's interesting as a development, right?
Certainly. I think we've been saying all along, simply say, look, that commission in itself did not serve the interest of the public. And as a result, we should declare it null and void. And we elated that, the courts have actually found it in our favor. So we feel vindicated. And this is, civil society truth to power and demanding transparency. So, yeah, we're very excited about this. Sets a good precedence moving forward to simply say our judiciary at all costs.
All right, so what does this mean? Canton asked the question just now, and I'm sure it's something that a lot of people are asking you this morning. So what? What happens now?
I think, Gareth, the background to this is that we along with, our civil society organizations like your Open Secrets and central figures like people like Andrew Feinstein, We made submissions to the commission, and that's not spoken about in public, that we actually gathered evidence and made submissions to the commission of which the commission didn't pay attention to. In fact, they set it aside. And that's one of the key findings within the judgment in itself, to simply say there was evidence that was provided that the commission didn't consider. So we are saying, we don't want another commission of inquiry. That's not what we're asking for. We're not saying let's establish another commission of inquiry at the taxpayer's cost. Already this one has cost us 147 million. What we're saying is that given all the evidence that was submitted there, wherever there is any indication of any wrongdoing or if there's any prima facie evidence that has been provided by all sections of society, the role players, like I said, civil society organizations, individuals, investigative journalists like Amapungani, we are calling on the law enforcement agencies, particularly the NPA, to then therefore pursue this evidence and in fact prosecute where necessary.
All right. I remember the Sariti Commission of Inquiry, and I remember Paul Hoffman, who was there representing Trevor Crawford Brown, I think, and he lost it. And he said basically this commission is a farce at the time. And he said that Thabo Mbeki, who was, I think, testifying there and then, he said that the whole thing was a joke because all of those ANC people who've benefited from the Arms Commission were effectively just minions. They were at the behest and the command of not just an arms dealer from outside of the country, but of each other, and that they would take instruction from whoever gave it in order to line their own pockets. Do you remember that discussion?
Yeah, vividly as it happened yesterday. And I think, and that's one of the things that we did not necessarily pay attention to, and that could have been a pressure point, particularly from the public or from the citizens of this country to actually demand a lot more accountability. I think it was a mediocre process with regards to how people were actually, questioned or cross-questioned in that commission. It was just a mere process to exonerate politicians. And the least said about Sariti's track record himself, mm-hmm, the better. So in essence, it was just a process to exonerate politicians. But the critical thing as well is it let off the hook the multinational corporations of arms dealers that were, in fact, in their very own countries, were found to actually have bribed.
Yeah, tell me, I was just about to ask you about that. I mean, we do know that BAE Systems and Thales, I think it was the French company, actually were fingered for having paid bribes. But to my understanding, this would not have stopped. I mean, the Sereti Commission findings would not have stopped a scenario where people who received those bribes could still actually be fingered and prosecuted for that matter. I guess what I'm trying to say, or get a sense from right now from you guys, what is the practical implication of setting aside the Sereti Commission findings? Where do we go from here as a country in terms of bringing people who were involved in corruption at any level to book?
I think, look, it's a watershed moment with regards to how then, you know, our government would pursue issues of accountability. Quite too often we've seen politicians being indicted in public. You think about the State Security Agency report from the high-level panel that fingered a couple of people like Busiabo Mangcwele and others, and very inactive government with regards to holding them to account. And we're hoping under these circumstances we would have a very proactive government that would essentially use its own power with the different, you know, government institutions that are there through the law enforcement. You know, you're looking at the Hawks and other role players in this regard to actually reopen these cases and prosecute people. We have strong institutions in this country that essentially, if they're not politically infiltrated to pursue other narrow interests, they would actually be able to be in the position to hold people to account. So for us, it's a question that I think we should put into the public discourse to simply say, can we afford to have an ineffective government that is simply not willing to prosecute people because they're politically connected, because they're politically high up? Because, you know, so that's the question that we should be asking, to simply say, how do we collectively as a society hold our government accountable to ensuring that corruption and malfeasance are actually clamped down, irrespective of who commits that? So for us, it would be interesting to see what the government would do with regards to sort of kind of pursuing some of the information that has come to light right now. And this is a test, really, of our own institutions, our own government, to simply see how far they're willing to go to ensure that justice is served and corruption is clamped down on.
So, Tammy, does that mean you guys are going to be pulling an EFF classic move in showing up at the police station with the evidence that you have to open a case against somebody and actually have a case number and force the hand of the NPA to actually go ahead and investigate and prosecute on some of the things that you guys say was never taken into account with the Sereti Commission?
That's but one move that that's open to us. But also to just also emphasize again, to say the one of the things that we can do moving forward is to force the Sereti Commission to in fact provide all the evidence that we had submitted to the law enforcement agencies for them to pursue. And then we put pressure on the law enforcement agencies to ensure that they actually follow through with some of the evidence that we have presented to them. So it's one of two options. One, we can show up and say, right, we're opening a case against certain individuals and here's the proof, but also to say it's the state's responsibility. And given that the commission was given that kind of, you know, we had submitted that kind of evidence, we would simply then mean we go back and demand that the Sereti Commission takes all this evidence that it had set aside and provide it to the law enforcement agencies, and then we put pressure on those.
Wouldn't it be nice to see a politician or two actually go to jail for stealing money?
We keep waiting, right? We keep waiting. I mean, I don't know how long we can keep on, you know, turning the other way every time a politician is found to have their hands in the cookie jar.
Well, I mean, it's so embarrassing that unless Shamila Batoy eventually does something after, 8 months now in the job, where we've been giving her plenty of leeway, unless she puts someone in front of a judge, or even better, in jail eventually with a successful prosecution, for doing things like all these commissions have discovered, unless she does it, I'm afraid we're going to have to rely on a private prosecution from AfriForum, and wouldn't that be embarrassing?
That would definitely be embarrassing, because, I mean, what else do we need? I mean, the courts are making these daring findings against these processes. Reports are fingering people.
Yep.
The email leaks are fingering people. What more evidence do we need to actually have a successful prosecution against at least one politician, for example? I mean, it remains a mockery that even, you know, it's almost 9 months now since the high-level panel on state security agency released the report that fingered Siyabonga Tshwele, for example, that fingered Jacob Zuma himself, and nothing, David Mahlobo, for example. Nothing has happened to any of them. No. So I think it's time that we need to call for greater accountability. And one of the pressure points is to simply say we're going to shout from the highest rooftops and actually ensure that we make sure that these state security, these state organs play their role. We should be calling on Shamila Batoi to do something.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Tami Nkosi, who is the Protest Surveillance and Securitization Organizer. Canton loves that title, for the Right to Know campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think he is exactly as impassioned as we all need to be about these things. But there's a lot of fingering during this discussion this morning, I just want to say.
I've withdrawn my fingers. As you can see my hand, I had, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. There's the chief fingerer right there.
You know, if that one thing that clip just reminds me of, and knowing the kind of pressure that our president is under with all the leaks and all the talk.
Does he know that he's under pressure?
Is he, Jacob Zuma, for all his faults, had the absolute fortitude to withstand so much pressure for so long from so many factors, even from within, you know, where he had people within his party.
Yep.
He was able to withstand that pressure. And the only thing that I've been thinking about our poor president over the past 10 days now is I wonder if he can stand this pressure.
He doesn't have the same strength of character that Jacob Zuma had. And I never thought I'd say that, but there it is. That's what we've got. That's how history will judge him. He has squandered the goodwill that he was handed on a silver platter. He has wasted time. He has tried to conciliate and reconcile, make friends with just about everybody to no avail. And he's being outmaneuvered by someone as rank and as deplorable as Ace Magashule. That should tell you a lot.
I don't know if he's being outmaneuvered by Ace Magashule. I'm not sure about
that. There are a few people who've outmaneuvered him. It's not. There's a long list, Pumi. All right. Can we move on to something else that I think interests a lot of people?
You mean we're not talking about the leaks?
We can.
The bank statements.
Sure.
And the first to fall of those bank statements. Young EFF commissars.
Oh, that's a very interesting topic, especially because those two young EFF commissars are exactly the sort of people who I mentioned before. They're grifters. These are low level. Listen,
grifters.
Most of our MPs, most of the members of the ANC NEC, are just grifters with grand titles. They're people who will take money from wherever it comes, from arms deal, you know, arms deals that were set up by foreign arms manufacturers. They'll take money from their political enemies. They will, under the table, anything goes. And it shows you that these people are without principle. And these two EFF commissars are probably only the first of a long list of people who will be revealed in future to have also supported Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma and have benefited from her largesse. We don't know who her funders were. We haven't seen anything about her. This is clearly a deliberate leak to make Cyril look worse than he already
looks. Actually, there has been an NDZ leak as well. I'm sure Pumi's seen some of them as well. I don't redistribute those things because, you know, they are basically defamatory in the absence of evidence. But it hasn't really stopped some newspapers from going ahead and publishing.
Who did they say is on her list?
No, they haven't published what's on her list. But
apart from taxpayers' money.
I can't name names. Because it does become actionable. But I'll be very happy to share it within this hallowed circle of ours.
Yes.
But I think the EFF commissars showed two things. When the list first came out and everybody was like, these bank statements, how true are they? You know, and everybody going through, combing through every name. I wonder what, you know, when they have time to do their day jobs. But it's fascinating for me that the first thing that came out on Sunday out of Bramfontein was we have engaged the person and we are satisfied with the fact, with their response as to why it is that they had to receive this money, and it was for a bereavement. And then 24 hours later, you know, the statement comes out. Actually, she's resigned. Actually, she took the money, not so much for the, she doesn't know the president. She, when the money came in, she doesn't know what it was. And it's just suddenly, I'm like, wow,
so
guys, yesterday you came out with the statement saying
and it was
what, bereavement.
What, 50,000 rand was the amount?
Yeah. Initially, okay. It was 40,000 rand, but by the time she was resigning, it was up to 80,000 rand.
Oh, okay.
Just
people
again.
Are out here running some kind of serious funerals.
But these,
you know?
these are people with just no principles. They will take money from wherever they can get it, like a magpie.
And the fact that now, you know, she's then been sanctioned, she's leaving, obviously leaving the EFF, mm-hmm. not the party, but she's not going to be a member of parliament. She's not going to have any positions, hold any positions. And for the next 5 years, so effectively they've, you know, taken her out of the running to even cross the floor to go over to the Cyril camp with the ANC camp. But I'm very interested to know what it is that she was expected to do for this money, because she was obviously not voting mm-hmm. in Nasrec.
Yeah.
So what was this money for?
I don't know. This is the strange thing about South African politics. It is the politics of patronage, especially in the ruling party.
And pimpies get paid.
Yo, Kosiam. Mm. Oh, Kosiam. I need a Dimpy Dimpopo soundbite of Oh, Kosiam. Mm. People yeah. are going
we
down.
We must record you doing that, and we'll just use it every now and then.
Bad way.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the other things that are going on. The eThekwini Council is a disaster. The Nelson Mandela Bay Council is a disaster. They're all falling apart. Even Herman Mashaba has challenges here in Johannesburg, despite making a deal with a number of the unions just a couple of days ago. It seems that our municipalities are faltering in a worse way than even we had imagined when we last spoke about this. Is government breaking down at all levels? We see Cyril's, you know, floundering, but even at the level where there's
a different question, where is government working?
Well, okay, we'll start with that one. Crickets, do I hear any replies? Where is government working?
I'm having difficulty actually coming up with something here at this point.
Yeah, well, we have so many distractions, don't we? We have commissions of inquiry on the one hand, we have court cases on the other hand, we have people, all of those things. And that's why I said, when do they find time for their day jobs? I mean, to have Mzwandile Masina going through these statements and pointing people out. While he is doing that, he's not doing what he should be doing.
But,
you know?
But can I ask you this then? Because every day that goes by where we don't have an active government, or if government breaks down and we don't have law enforcement and any of that stuff, people start to realize that they actually don't need these people. Ordinary citizens.
Well, they act with impunity, as we've seen with all of the violence that happens on an ongoing
Richards
basis.
Richards Bay.
Organized violence.
Can we talk about Richards Bay?
What happened in Richards Bay?
There were massive protests
yesterday.
In Richards Bay. Yeah. People were attacked.
You call,
roads were barricaded.
You call them protests. I call them riots.
Well, they are riots. They are riots. We don't know what these people are protesting about, but they are breaking the law. They are damaging private property. They are blocking roads.
And the main reason why you do it is because you know that you can get away with it.
Yeah. So what, I mean, what does this mean though for the future of government? Because people, if they have this kind of laissez-faire policy to the law, then it's only a matter of time before they decide that actually anarchy suits them better.
I think that decision has already pretty much been reached.
By consensus.
Yeah. I mean, it just basically happens. So if you happen to be part of the middle class in this country, then you are the only target group that government can still effectively pick on. But on the assumption that you're very rich or poor, then you're effectively out of government's grasp because you're not part of the tax net, which means that there's no way that government can actually come after you and take your money.
Hmm.
And so both of those groups really are laws unto themselves.
The very rich and the very poor.
Yes.
Huh. All right. Can we discuss?
See with the private armies that the very rich have deployed in their streets, you know, and the gated communities and the closing down even of public roads.
Well, if we are to have this long talked of IMF bailout at some point, they will create what are called economic exclusion zones.
Well, again, if we talk in terms of the IMF bailout, remember that I said last week that before the IMF bailout happens, they're going to come for our pension funds.
Yeah.
And this whole thing about going after prescribed assets. Yeah, which is something that's now very much part of the ANC's vocabulary. And we're going to be hearing a lot more of it going forward. And I think that that's going to be the point of looting that's going to happen before we get to the point where an IMF bailout actually needs to happen. So there's still money to be stolen before we get to an IMF bailout.
Jesus. All right. I do the burning platform every week with the hope that we will find some silver lining. Are there any things going on internationally or locally at the moment that are making you happy, that show that we're moving in the right direction?
Sure.
In politics, nothing ever makes me happy.
No. But I'm talking generally.
That India spacecraft is now successfully orbiting the moon.
Well, that's a good start.
Yeah.
And the Hong Kong protests are still holding out.
They are holding out.
That is a silver lining. I think, you know, that they're standing their ground and they're fighting.
I have a completely different view on the Hong Kong protests. I'm very clear that those protests are actually being orchestrated and that there's actually money flowing into that country, which is allowing this process to continue. If you consider that.
Orchestrated by whom?
Aha. Yeah, fair question.
Well, go on. You can't leave it open-ended like
look,
that. What are your suppositions?
Certainly,
with that smile.
Look, I have friends in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. okay, and they're Hong Kong Chinese people who are very firmly committed to the whole idea of Hong Kong as a special administrative region that has its own laws and so forth. And, you know, trust me, they're absolutely passionate about Hong Kong, and they're fairly convinced that the money that is flowing into the country is coming from the U.S.
So?
Yes. Now, the whole idea is, if you consider what actually is going to be achieved by the destruction of Hong Kong capitalism, which ultimately is what is going to happen.
Is that the objective of the Chinese or of someone else?
No, it's not the objective of the Chinese. Even during the most repressive time of the Chinese, Hong Kong was always
an exception.
Hong Kong was an artery that enabled China to engage with the rest of the world. Mm. It basically was a pipeline.
So who would be of the stated objective of destroying Hong Kong capitalism? Whose purpose is that? Remember
right now that Hong Kong, you know, being Hong Kong dollar is absolutely freely tradable, and it's a strong, stable currency. And it actually allows an effective way for money to flow in and out of the mainland, effectively bypassing U.S. sanctions to a large level. And you ask yourself what role Hong Kong currently plays in terms of kind of being a bulwark against the U.S. dollar to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've already seen a situation where Alibaba was about to be investing on the Hong Kong stock market. They've now pulled back from that. You've had Hong Kong billionaires who are now suddenly buying property in places like Malaysia because they're getting concerned about the situation. Remember that in terms of the deal that was signed between the British and
China,
that the special status for Hong Kong is really only for 50 years. Mm. So after 50 years, the gloves are off. And then China can pretty much do what it wants.
Right.
You know, in terms of the deal. Well, look, from a military point of view, they could pretty much do what they want right now. But
so you don't think, I mean, Kant and I'm all up for a conspiracy theory. And even if there is American money pouring into Hong Kong, these are ordinary people who are not, they have no skin in the game other than to be part of this protest because they care about this,
well,
this issue. There are ordinary citizens taking to the streets every day, putting themselves in harm's way.
I think at the point at which the protests around the extradition were taking place, that was very much the case. Now you suddenly have protests in support of effectively regime change in Hong Kong. And remember that these are protesters who are displaying the British flags and the American flags.
And
now, consider that Hong Kong is it's an extremely expensive place to live in if you're unemployed. Now, if you're able to take to the streets on a daily basis and still able to feed yourself in Hong Kong, there's money for that coming from somewhere. And that's a very critical difference between a situation like Venezuela, where you literally have nothing, and therefore you take into the streets and protest.
Aren't the Maduro regime still driving tanks over people in Venezuela?
Yes, very much so.
It's going very well.
The Chinese are also getting ready to drive tanks over people in the periphery.
I wonder how Bernie and the squad are feeling about their much loved Venezuela now. You don't ever hear them dialing back the socialism. They never go, well, okay, Venezuela's not a great example.
Yes, but Venezuela didn't do it properly. In the US, they will do it properly and make it work. But again, you know, going back to Hong Kong, you know, certainly, and you know, Hong Kong's one of my favorite places on the planet. I absolutely love Hong Kong. The people out there have this spirit of entrepreneurship, which is just absolutely phenomenal. And wherever you walk in that city on a normal basis, there's a constant buzz and people are excited. And so if you look in terms of, yes, the protests are huge, but in terms of the population of Hong Kong as a whole, do they actually count at the level of saying this is something equivalent to an Arab Spring? I don't think so. Is it actually causing huge disruption in terms of the day-to-day lives of people in Hong Kong and their ability to actually build up capitalism in this country so that they can, in 25 years' time, because remember, they're already at the halfway mark in terms of their before Red China is able to step in.
Isn't it like in 2030 something or something?
Yeah, so they're already at the halfway mark, so there's 25 years to go. And essentially, they've got that 25 years to build up the economy to the level where when the time comes for China to be able to fully exert whatever political system it wants, for there to be a compelling reason for China to actually leave them pretty much alone. And I think right now everything is actually trying to force a Tiananmen Square situation. I'm very clear that a Tiananmen Square situation is not going to happen.
No, I think that for the Chinese, that would be a PR nightmare.
They would never do so. And then the thing about the Chinese is that they think long term in ways that other people don't think long term. So, you know, from the time that, that Deng Xiaoping negotiated the Hong Kong handover with, Margaret Thatcher at the time. So remember that the Hong Kong handover was negotiated in 1982.
Yes.
And it wasn't actually negotiated. What happened was Deng sat down with Margaret Thatcher and he said, I can put 1 million troops into Hong Kong in an hour. What can you do about it?
Yeah.
And that's the point at which Thatcher said, let's talk.
It's a good point to start a negotiation. Can I ask you two about something a little more social rather than political, although it has a political flavor to it? Gillette a while ago did a whole toxic masculinity campaign. Do you remember it?
Yeah, Kenton tweeted about this.
Right. And I saw that they've lost $12 billion in revenue. Ordinary men, the silent majority you could call them, of men who are tired of being called toxic males, just guys who are going about their day-to-day life. Maybe they've got children and wives and they're trying to live their lives as normally and as responsibly as possible. Turned their backs on Gillette. Gillette have suddenly dialed back that campaign, by the way. And people are saying it's the go woke, go broke phenomenon, or get woke, go broke. Apparently, Gillette has done a backflip after that toxic masculinity backlash and has said, instead, we will continue to represent men at their best, shifting the spotlight from social issues to local heroes. What do we make of this?
Look, I think again, correlation does not imply causation. And, you know, I took a snipe at Gillette to say, hey, guess what? You know, it looks like your, identity politics campaign didn't really work the way that it was meant to. But in point of fact, if you consider that, again, the whole question of the economy, Gillette is a overpriced product. mm-hmm. if you think about it. And there are lots of now competitors. I mean,
there's a
startup that actually delivers razors, craft razors, they call them, directly to your home.
Yeah, locally there's one as well.
Yes.
And these guys are very good. I've used them for a while.
Dude, wow. Have you seen the number of people with beards just on the street? Like, just that.
Yeah. That's what's made Gillette lose their money.
Like,
I think they should be targeting women with beards as a new market. I feel strongly about this.
There are women out there shaving their legs and their armpits. That's who they should be targeting.
All right. Well, that brings an end to the burning platform for this morning.
Wait, but I have to tell you, because we've got...
But wait, there's more.
This one is a slightly interesting, because we had our Dacha is now for recreational use.
Yes,
right?
Correct.
I read a thing about a Mexico judge approving recreational cocaine.
For only two people. Jeez.
Yeah, it starts
with two lucky people.
It starts with two. It's a slippery slide.
I don't know if it's lucky. I mean, you need to be able to afford the cocaine, sure.
Well, I know your position on this is very much libertarian. Let people put into their bodies and do with their bodies what they will, as long as they're a consenting adult of a requisite age. And they have the necessary mental capacity to be able to.
Yeah, and then regulate and tax the stuff as it's coming along.
Correct.
Not that I support taxation, but.
Or regulation.
Yes.
It might help the economy of Colombia.
And just quickly, someone says you were going to talk about the economic exclusion zones within an IMF bailout. Please explain that. To be perfectly honest, I've only heard about them, and I know that they will be a part of any deal, but I don't know much about them.
Well, it would actually mean overturning specific parts of our law. So, you know, things like the Labor Relations Act, for example, or the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, or everything related to broad-based black economic empowerment. And the only people in the world who really have the power to do that is FIFA.
Yeah, we saw that in 2010. Yeah. They completely ignored all those rules.
Yeah, so effectively.
So what we need is President Sepp Blatter back.
Exactly.
Damn it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Pumi, Canton, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us this morning and for being a part of the Burning Platform. It is brought to you by Nando's Spicy Hot this morning. And you can do it with a side of coleslaw in case you are still peckish. So there we go. Next week we'll be back with another Burning Platform. Thank you very much. CliffCentral.com.
This is CliffCentral.com.